I just love reading these sort of chapters, like Matthew 8, just typical chapter from the Gospels. There we are with the Lord. I mean, he's the one we love, isn't it? He's the one who should be at the absolute center of all our thinking and imagination and the whole source, really, of all our living and thinking. And there we are. We have him right before us. So just going to go through the chapter and bring out a few reflections on really the beauty of his words and his whole character and his whole way of being. Verse 4, he cures this leper, and he says, verse 4, don't tell anybody, but go your way and show yourself to the priest. Why don't tell anybody? Well, it seems to me that just by sort of walking around as he was, this cured person, this would be such a silent witness that he didn't actually need to say any words. It was by his silent witness that there was the leper, and wow, he's cured. And I think that this is how it really is, that so often the real witness is not in any words that we might make, and certainly not in any exposition that we might come out with, but in who we are. And that's how it was to be, that this man was just to walk around as he was, cured. Just, he was the witness. And another lovely point there, and offer the gift that Moses commanded, that is for the cleansing of the leper, for a testimony unto the priests, for a witness unto them. Now, it's been pointed out that perhaps leprosy had never been really cured in the sense that Jesus cured it, and so therefore the prescribed offering for what to offer when your leprosy was cleansed had perhaps not been used much, or not been practically, this wasn't possible to use it, because no one had really been cured of leprosy in the way that Jesus cured them. Now, whatever it is, the point is that this sacrifice that he was going to make was going to beg the question from the priests, well, how did you get cured? And the answer was going to be Jesus. And that sacrifice, that cleansing ritual, was to be a testimony, a witness unto the priests. Now, we might think that the priests, the Jewish hierarchy, were the last lot who were going to really respond. And yet, in Acts 6, verse 7, we read that a great company of the priests were obedient to the faith. Significant, I think, that this incident is recorded in all three of the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's as if it had a special ring to each of the gospel writers, because they were obviously struck with this, that Jesus at the time had told this cured man to go and make a witness to the priests, and everyone would have thought, but they're the people who hate you, Jesus, they're just not interested. And it was that great company of priests who later accepted the faith, according to Acts 6 verse 7. So I think you see there the hopefulness of Jesus and his desire to win people. Now, if we don't have a hopefulness for people, which is in a sense another form of a desire to see God's glory, we won't in the end witness to anybody, because it seems that nobody is interested. And that emotion, that feeling, that idea where they're not interested, nobody's interested, you know, this is wrong, this is not the attitude we should have. Because if Jesus had that attitude, he'd have thought, yeah, well, I'll teach the common people, but not the priests. I mean, they're the last lot. The point is, he was searching for faith in people, as he does in us. And you see that sort of focus on the positive, really, in verses 6 and 7 and 8, where this centurion comes to him and says, I got this sick servant, please can you heal the servant? And he says, I'm a man under authority, and I've got servants under me. He says, verse 9, I say to one servant, go, and he goes. So therefore, can you please cure my servant from a distance? And Jesus says, wow, verse 10, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. But this centurion, like a lot of people at the time, would have believed in demons, and he thought that his servant was sick, I guess, because of demonic powers. And so he says, look, I can say to my servants, go, everything's under your control, Jesus, you tell these demons to go, and they will go. So you can do this. Now, Jesus doesn't say, you know what, you kind of don't get it, you don't understand. Now, no miracle for you, buddy, because you're a bit astray theologically. There aren't no such things as demons, God is all-powerful, etc. He doesn't do that. He responds to the person's faith. And he focuses on the fact that this person believes. And you know, when he says, I have not found such great faith, no, not in Israel, the implication is that, wow, in Israel there is really great faith. But this man's got even, this Gentile, has got even more faith than there is in Israel. Well, I wouldn't exactly describe Israel at the time as having much faith in it. But there you are. He wanted to, or he had this way of looking at people positively. And the Gospels seem to stress how sensitive he was to the faith of people. But you can actually see it on the next chapter, Matthew 9, 22. Jesus is touched by this woman who thinks that if she just touches his clothing that she's going to get healed, and just like Russian Orthodox and Catholics think that if you touch certain holy relics you get blessing, etc. And Jesus doesn't turn around and say to her, look here, that's totally wrong, there's nothing special about my clothes. He turns around and says, your faith has actually made you whole. So he focuses on the positive in this woman. And his sensitivity to others' spirituality and to their faith and the way he's so thrilled by it is all the more remarkable when you consider that compared to his faith, the best of human faith and of love and devotion is absolutely nothing compared to his. And yet all the same, height of spirituality that he had did not, as it were, distance him from us. He was so spiritual exactly because he saw us so positively. Now, we need faith in this. We need to hear this, because later on in the New Testament you come to Paul writing to the Romans and he says that Jesus counts us as if we are righteous. We are counted righteous. We are looked at as if we are holy and unreprovable, unblameable in his sight, in his eyes. And we look at our own weakness and we think, wow, how can he do that? And here's the answer as to how he can look at you and me as if we are so wonderful, with all the imputing of righteousness, if you like, that comes from love, of being in love, of seeing the beloved as wonderful, as perfect. Now, where do we get the encouragement that Jesus really does that with you and me tonight? You get it from reading the Gospels here, these lovely chapters that we're just going through here, and seeing how he actually does that to people. Here's this centurion with a wrong idea about demons being cast out, and there's a number of examples of that, and Jesus is like, okay, I'll run with you. You believe that I can do this? Okay, I'm with you. He's very quick to focus on the faith that there was. He was very perceptive of that. And so you come on there and they bring unto him, verse 16, many people possessed with demons. Well, demon possession, I submit, is really the language of the day for mental illness, or illness and maybe deformity, which could not be explained by any medical method that they knew at the time. And Jesus cures them, 17, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah, saying, himself took our infirmities and bare our diseases. Which incidentally means that the demon-possessed people and the spirits, as it says, being cast out of them, they're sort of paralleled with human diseases that were being cured. But the point is that Matthew quotes here from Isaiah 53, verse 4, in a passage that is very clearly talking about what happened on the cross, that Jesus took and carried our infirmities and our sins, our diseases, on the cross. In fact, took our infirmities can be translated, he took them up, as in he carried them up onto the cross. And yet here, that prophecy about the crucifixion is quoted about an incident or an aspect of the mortal life of Jesus before he died. And there's quite a few examples of that, and I think what it shows is that the cross, in one sense, was ongoing. It was not a supreme act of devotion at the end of his life that was so out of character and out of proportion with his earlier life. He had lived the spirit of the cross all the way through. And when the final thing came, the actual physicality of it, he therefore triumphed so gloriously because actually he had lived in the spirit of crucifixion all his life. So then, in what sense then did Jesus take up our sins or our infirmities and bear them and carry them in his body on the cross? Well, I don't think it can mean in any metaphysical sort of sense, but I understand this language of taking or bearing or carrying, taking up. I understand this really as meaning identified. He identified to the point of effective unity with human sin and with human disease and weakness. And that, again, I think shows the beauty of his character, his sensitivity, in the sense that he could identify with mentally disturbed people. Those who are described in the language of the day as demon-possessed. And in fact, it seems in the Gospels he had a special interest in those people. And he who had, as the Son of God, and don't forget he did have that divine side to him, he who had the most well-developed human mind, who would have been so sharp, as it were, that he would have figured things like gravity well before it was figured out generally. He would have been up with Einstein, well beyond Einstein, and if he'd let his mind wander down those sort of paths, he would have worked out all kind of truths about the world in which he found himself, that the world was round, for example. You know, he would have sat there amongst those simple village folk and probably, if he let his mind wander on it, started working out the surface tension on that glass of water, that mug of water that was sitting in front of him. You know, he had that kind of a mind because he was the Son of God. And of course, it was a mind that above all was spiritually in tune with God. And yet he had this special ability to be sensitive and to identify with the mentally disturbed, the mentally broken. You know, some people are so broken psychologically and mentally that, you know, they will never cure. They've gone through trauma or whatever it is they've been through, and really that's it. And particularly in those days with really no such thing as therapy and suddenly no medication for that sort of thing. I mean, these poor people were in a terrible situation. And he had a particular identity with the incurable, the mentally incurable, humanly speaking. And I love that about him. I really do. That huge sensitivity and ability to identify. And Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so if you there are bemoaning your sort of existential loneliness, that there is no one who identifies with you, maybe you are dead right, maybe there is not on this earth, but there is ultimately in heaven. And that is why there is this kind of mystery to the cross, that he died for all of us, and yet he died, as Paul says, you know, the Son of God loved me and gave himself for me. That we can see him and understand him as having died for me personally because of this personal identity with us. And yet, on the other hand, he is very demanding. Verse 22, he asks this guy to come and follow him, and he says, sure, but I just got to go to my father's funeral. I just got to go bury my father. And Jesus said to him, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. It's a terrible picture, really, of sort of letting the dead bodies drag one more dead body into their grave. You would have thought that for someone as sensitive as Jesus, he would have said, oh, yeah, sure, yeah, you poor guy. In Jewish thought, I mean, to bury your father, this was the greatest duty, really, to bury your father. And in under some sort of Pharisaic kind of views, to perform the last offices for the dead was really the greatest of all the good works that you could do. And of course, Jesus knew that. He knew how fanatic the Jews were about burying parents. And it's exactly on that point that he chooses to be so demanding. The Jesus who is so demanding is also the Jesus who is so sensitive. The point is, he is love itself, and he does this kind of thing in our lives too. He can ask you at the most painful point, and he doesn't do it because he's mean. I mean, to turn around and say God's a hard man, or Jesus is, unreasonable, he's a hard man, and that sort of thing. This is terrible. This is a terrible, tragic misunderstanding of who he is and why he acts this way. He is love itself and sensitivity itself to the consequences of all that he asks us to do. But he knows that it must be that way if we are to follow him and thereby to follow him to his death and to the kingdom. Now, there's another thing in here. But he was talking to religious people, and they would have been aware of Leviticus 21:11, that forbade the high priest to be polluted by the corpse of his parents. And the high priest was sort of precluded from the usual Jewish way of burying parents, burying the dead. It's as if Jesus is inviting all of us to see ourselves as the high priest. Now, Judaism in the first century was rather like Catholicism and Russian Orthodoxy here in Eastern Europe at this time, where you go to church really not so much to get any encouragement, but you go there to be told how bad you are, that you're this, you're that, and the other, and you're a rabble, and, by grace you might have a bit of chance of salvation, but you're basically spiritually no good. And that's what they were basically told. The average Palestinian Jew of that time would have gone to the synagogue, and this is basically what they were being told. That you don't get it, you are the people of the land, you're not spiritual, the wrath of God is upon you because you don't keep the law strictly enough, etc., etc. And yet Jesus is saying that each person who follows him is none less than the high priest. And also, Jeremiah was forbidden to participate in lamenting for the dead, and Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 24, is forbidden to carry out mourning rituals for his wife's funeral. Why? Because they were asked to go urgently and spread the gospel. And so it is, I think, with the Lord's call here. He says, you're about something so urgent and so holy that you as the high priest, you as the prophets. And it's also written in some of the writings of the Maccabees in the Apocrypha, that a man could be excused burying his father if he had to go in time of war, in a war situation, to fight the enemy or to save a life. And Jesus is saying, you are in just that kind of intense frontline situation. If you're going to spread the gospel, if you're truly going to follow me, if you're going to take the message to others, you are living on a knife edge. You really are. This is not something to do just pressing a few buttons on the internet when you've got nothing else to do. This is not a hobby. This is not now and again. This is not Sunday morning only. There is an urgency to this task. He's getting us to try to sense a sense of absolute intensity and pressing urgency in what we are about if we are truly following him. Now, all the time he's searching and seeking ways of trying to impress upon us the urgency of our situation. And there's a number of times when he acts in a strange way, I think, to make his people realize the urgency of their situation. And you've got an example, I think, later on in this chapter when they're on the sea. And it says in verse 24, but he was asleep. Well, okay, it does say in 25 that they woke him up. But I wonder if he was really asleep. Was he not just trying to pique their intensity of need for him? Sure, he knew what was happening. It says in 23, when he was entered into a boat, his disciples followed him. They didn't want to take this journey, I don't think. So he went there, sat on his own, or made as if maybe he was going to push off in their boat on his own, and okay, then they came. They probably could sense there was going to be this huge, dangerous storm coming. Now, I think that he made out he was asleep, so that they would try not to wake him up, they would try to do their best, and the thing would get worse and worse, and then they would be desperate. It's rather like on the way to Emmaus. He made as if he was going to go further. And they said, oh no, don't go further. Come home with us. He made out, he was, no, I'm not stopping here, I'm going to walk on. No, please don't do that. And so this is how he is with us. He piques, I would say, our interest in him, our desperation for him. The apparent silence of God and of Jesus must be understood, I think, in that way. And yet, all the time, it is for our blessing, for our benefit, because he wants us to be saved. And so he goes on to cure these mentally disturbed people. And it's always kind of sad to me, really, in verse 34, that after this, they came out to meet Jesus, having seen the cured mentally disturbed people, and they said, please go away. Well, I know they could have said this maybe because they were a bit miffed that he'd killed all their pigs. But the record, the way it's worded, seems to draw the connection between the fact that they saw, that they were aware, they were told by the people who kept the pigs, what had happened to these mentally disturbed people, those that had been possessed with demons. And they were, they just couldn't handle it. It was too good news for them. And this happens, I think, a number of times, that people somehow couldn't cope with it. It was too good news. When you think, really, of what Jesus did, how he cured wide-eyed, spastic children, how he, you know, raised the dead, how he gave legs and limbs to the crippled and sent whole families away just giggling with joy and rejoicing and praising because of the miracles he'd done. And those same people basically turned around and killed him. They certainly didn't stand up for him in the final end. And it's as if people, like, I will go so far but not further. All jolly good stuff, but no, I don't want this. It's so sad. It's rather like when all the believers are gathered together praying for Peter to be released. And then Rhoda comes running in and says, you know what, Peter's outside. And they said, no, you're crazy, girl. Like, calm down, we're praying. No, Peter's outside. The prayer's been heard right now. I told you once, I'll tell you again, girl, calm down. We are praying. Don't disturb people when they're praying. Didn't you know, girl, it's kind of rude. It was too good to believe that actually your prayer has been heard right there and then. And there is something about the simple statements of the Gospels, of the Gospel, that we will be saved, that Jesus loves us, that The Jesus who loved little children, who cured mentally disturbed people, who identified with them, who cured the centurion's servant, who was amazed at the centurion's faith, who stretched forth his hand and touched the leper, all the wonderful things that we've read here just in this one chapter. Obviously, he loves us, and he is going to save us. But there's something in us that shies away from it, and it's simply our unbelief. And that is what we have to chase away that unbelief, and to rejoice in faith, in the simple fact that the Son of God loved me and gave himself for me.